radio.org or ask your smart speaker to play Radio Catskill.
Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, journalist Nina Burley is back with reaction to the latest Trump cabinet picks and on what more to expect and when and how in the new Trump administration and what a resistance movement might look like. Her overall advice? Brace yourself. Post-election Catskill Mountain Keepers urging more community involvement. We speak with the executive director of Catskill Mountain Keeper, Ramsey Adams. The winter Main Street Farmers Market is back at the Cooperage in Honesdale. It has a significant impact on the community and local farmers. We'll learn more. And Sloane Wainwright from the acclaimed family of artists, brother Loudon, sister-in-law Kate McGarrigle, nephew Rufus. She's performing Sunday at Music on the Delaware. We'll get a preview. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President-elect Donald Trump has announced new nominations for his incoming government. They include former Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard for Director of National Intelligence and former Florida Congressman Matt Gaetz for Attorney General. South Dakota Republican Senator John Thune has been elected as the incoming Senate Majority Leader. He spoke before the latest nominees were announced, but says all Trump nominees will receive a fair hearing.
The Senate has an advise and consent role under the Constitution, so we will do everything we can to process his noms quickly, get them installed in their position so they can begin to implement his agenda.
But the nomination of Gaetz is drawing consternation. He's been investigated by the Justice Department and the House of Representatives over allegations of sexual trafficking. Those probes were ended. But Alaska Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski is troubled.
I don't think it's a serious nomination for the Attorney General. That's Lisa Murkowski's view.
She spoke to MSNBC. Thousands of French police are being deployed around a Paris stadium ahead of a soccer match tonight between the French and Israeli national teams. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley says it's going ahead despite anti-Semitic violence at a similar match in Amsterdam.
France coach Didier Deschamps says it's difficult to prepare for a match under such tension. He's been urging people to just treat this as a normal soccer game, but it's anything but. Some 4,000 police, that's four times more than usual, will be on duty at the stadium in addition to 1,200 stadium workers. There will be double layers of security both inside and outside the stadium, and nearby bars and restaurants, usually full at match time, are required to close tonight. The Stade de France holds 80,000 people, but fewer than 13,000 tickets have been sold. That breaks down to a police officer for every three people. France's President Emmanuel Macron says he will be at the game to support France and send a message of fraternity and solidarity. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
In the U.S., telehealth companies say that sales for birth control and morning after pills have soared following Donald Trump's election victory. Texas Public Radio's Gabriela Alcorto Solario reports that's especially true in states with abortion bans.
WISP, a sexual and reproductive telehealth company, reported that from November 5th through 6th, orders for pills used in medication abortions were up 600%, and emergency contraceptive sales were up almost 1,000%. Birth control sales were also up 50%, according to a statement from WISP. WISP also says new patient purchases in states with abortion bans, such as Texas, saw a 930% increase. Another telehealth company, Winx Health, reported an increase of 500% in the morning after pills in states with abortion bans. Winx Health co-founder Jamie Norwood said they are committed to educating the public, especially in a Trump administration, to ensure women are making informed decisions. I'm Gabriela Alcorta Solorio in San Antonio.
On Wall Street, the Dow was down nearly 20 points. This is NPR. The satirical media outlet The Onion has announced that it has bought InfoWars, the media assets belonging to conspiracy theorist Alex Jones. He was ordered to sell by a bankruptcy court to pay down his debt to Sandy Hook families. Jones owes them $1.5 billion in defamation suits. He spread lies that the mass shooting at the Connecticut Elementary School didn't happen. Yesterday's sale to The Onion still needs to be approved by a judge. Federal health officials were in California's Central Valley this week, part of a pilot program to help contain bird flu. From member station KVPR, Carrie Klein reports the virus has now been detected across the country in at least 46 people and hundreds of dairy cattle herds.
On Monday and Tuesday, testing for avian influenza took place under a red tent outside a Walgreens in the Tulare County city of Visalia. Brian Strong with Walgreens says it was for farm workers who might have had contact with infected cattle or poultry.
It's a COVID and flu test that we're going to do on site here. And then we specifically take a sample to look to see if it is actually the bird flu strain.
This was part of a brand new CDC pilot program to test for bird flu in two states. The turnout this week, not so good. But they'll be back again next week. For NPR News, I'm Carrie Klein in Visalia.
President Biden is flying to Peru today to attend an international economic summit. He'll meet Chinese President Xi Jinping on Saturday. The White House says Biden will tell his counterpart, the U.S. and China, must maintain stability, clarity, and predictability as President-elect Donald Trump prepares to govern the U.S. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at WTGrantFoundation.org. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Nina Burley is an award-winning journalist and author, most recently of the novel Zero Visibility Possible. She's also a contributing editor at The New Republic and has written this week's cover story for the magazine, Trump 2.0, Here Comes the Night. Nina Burley is joining us once again, this time from the streets of Manhattan. Welcome back.
Thank you. So good to be talking to Catskill Radio.
Well, the last time we spoke was last Thursday, right after the election. That was sobering. And since then, things have been moving at lightning speed. Donald Trump has been naming people for top government jobs fast and furiously, seemingly favoring loyalty over experience. You kind of write about this in the article of this idea of shock and awe, but you're talking about day one. It seems to have started now, though, with these cabinet picks.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think that the shock and awe part of it is he's not wasting any time sending messages to the establishment and also to the Republicans in the Congress who are going to, as one of them said, if he tells us to jump and scratch our heads, we'll jump and scratch our heads.
Yeah.
So he's testing that, it's hard to imagine that they won't stand up against Matt Gaetz, who is, the closest he's ever gotten to a prosecutor. I mean, I think he has a law degree, but the closest he's ever gotten to a prosecutor is in his own sexual trafficking case down in Florida, which apparently the documents related to it are. Whether or not we ever see the light of day on those is up in the air now because he resigned from Congress this morning, the day before the, I think, bipartisan committee was going to rule on an ethics case related to his behavior in Tallahassee. That will be our attorney general.
Yeah.
So start with that.
Right. And Matt Gaetz has signaled that he wants to along the lines with, what Donald Trump says is abolishing every one of the three-letter agencies like the FBI and the ATF as attorney general, if confirmed, would be in charge of those. Many people are shocked by this, but there have been a few other bombshell picks as well. Pete Hegseth, a military veteran who's also a Fox News host, to be the defense secretary, defense.
He is a veteran. There are pictures of him in full armor in the Middle East. But let's just add that his real claim to fame related to the military is that he is a major, major supporter of forgiving war crimes among our troops. And he was out about that. He wrote a whole book about it. During Trump 1.0, he was out there defending these guys who were just thrill killing Afghans, who got called up on court martial and are I think walking free. So that's where he's coming from.
Awesome.
And yes, the TV, the TV readiness. One of the things that I picked up when I was interviewing people for this article about what a Trump 2.0 might look like is that. As far as the media, Trump, Fox News, like Sean Hannity in some ways in Trump 1.0 was almost like his attorney general. Like that, what Fox started to complain about, or, you know, if they focused on somebody or targeted somebody, he would pretty quickly, Pete, Donald Trump would pretty quickly respond publicly. And so the expectation is that, like, they work in tandem. So, yeah, I mean, you know, it's no surprise that he, that's where he doesn't read. He gets his information from TV. So Fox is going to be the conduit, and was the conduit, and is now still going to be the conduit to his cortex.
Michael Waldman, the president of the Brennan Center for Justice, said in an interview with the New York Times that, quote, these appointees that he was referring to are so appalling, they're a form of performance art. Is this just his way of getting attention? And, you know, what's the likelihood of some of these extreme folks getting confirmed? I guess it's probably more likely now that there's control of the Senate and the House in Republican hands.
Well, I think, you know, early reports are, anyway, that John Thune, who looks to be the replacement for McConnell as Senate leader, will consider allowing Trump to appoint what they do as, I think, absentee appoint, or I can't remember, vacation appoint. Where,
recess appointment.
Recess appointment, which is skirting the confirmation process, and just, you know, and that's a major authoritarian move, that you would just pick, you know, completely skirt all norms and just decide, I'm just going to pick these, you know, my cabinet, and there will be no input. There will be no FBI background checks. You know, they really want to get rid of that stuff too, because remember Jared Kushner, you know, number one son-in-law, he didn't pass his security clearance early on, and they really wanted him to be the Middle East envoy or whatever they called him. So they managed to get around that, but they don't like the security clearances. Why? Because they're surrounded. I'm sorry to say this, but there's a lot of kleptocracy going on here, and some of those people that he wants to come in, certainly Gates, would be, I would think, somewhat problematic given the sex trafficking situation that he was involved with his pals down in Tallahassee.
We're talking to Nita Burley, a journalist and author, most recently of the book Zero Visibility Possible. She's a contributing editor at The New Republic. Her cover story on the magazine this week is Trump 2.0, Here Comes the Night. You talk about in the article, what day one really might look like. And we mentioned, you know, this shock and awe idea. There are definitely a lot of guesses about the order of the business on that day one, but in your reporting, and again, we should note that you spoke to several people, former government officials, experts in American law, politics, and national security, civil society, NGOs, and activists to get a consensus on what to expect. What are some of the things that folks are saying that might be happening on that first day?
Well, you know, I wrote this before we see, you know, what we saw happening yesterday, which is just, you know, a flagrant scorn for norms. But I think that the expectation is that, and his chief of staff, Susie Wiles, said this yesterday, that there will be many, many, many executive orders on day one. So that is going to be shock and awe. But I think the order of business, as I understood it, what they expect is that he will first try to fire or set up this system in which they can fire, you know, tens of thousands of federal employees and replace them with political appointees. And that is something that they're probably going to do right away. He'll probably start some kind of deportation roundup just to send the message. He's not going to announce a million, you know, roundups, but what they'll do is probably target, like, meatpacking plants or factories or a community here and there. And, you know, the parents just won't come home from work that day. You know, the kids will be, you know, start the fear, the terroristic kind of assault on these minority communities, migrants. And then of course, they always do this. Actually, all Republicans do this as soon as they come in. He'll reverse the all the Biden limits on drill, baby, drill, and they're going to Now, Biden didn't really, you know, there is a lot of drilling going on in America. It was a giant lie that we're not a major energy driller. Fossil fuels are being dug up left and right here in this country. We are the largest energy producer in the world right now. But he's going to probably send that kind of message too. And, you know, let's not talk about climate change. That'll be banned like it is in Florida. You know, Hurricane Alley. Of course, those hurricanes are man-made. If you're a MAGA, you believe that the government's making them. But climate change won't be on the table anymore as a conversation piece. Maybe they'll try to do something with abortion, Comstock Act, where they will say, you know, the pill. I don't know. I mean, I'm still waiting. I wrote my little freak show column essay yesterday about Bobby Kennedy because I'm still waiting to hear whether they actually pull that off and put Bobby in charge of HHS, FDA. I mean, you know, this is a guy who's so completely unfit to oversee any kind of public health and science-related government operations. And so that's going to be a very interesting step if he does that. I think that when they go after that kind of thing, it's a real message to the public that, you know, all bets are off on any kind of agreed reality and you know, just the absolute distrust of expertise. It's going to be open season on you know, any kind of, you know, again, agreed upon reality. And that is an autocratic, style of governing.
I want to go back to something you said about Susie Wiles, the next White House chief of staff. She was privately speaking to a group of Republican donors on Monday in Las Vegas, and she mentioned to them that this they would be prepared on day one. And the reason that they're going to be so prepared, according to this article, was that in order for Mr. Trump to revolutionize government, they only have about 2 years, which seemed to be an acknowledgement of most presidents facing a difficult midterm election cycle after 2 years in office. So really, they're focused on this shock and awe speed of light thing because they know they have maybe 2 years before the next the midterms come in. And so that kind of
I think I know what you're going to say. But when you say that, I think, well, that's actually kind of a shining light on the horizon.
Right.
Or, you know, there's cause for hope because we think, you know, that he has possibly going to carry through with his promise to be a dictator, not just on day one, but, you know, he told his Christian followers no need for elections ever again, that there's some way that they would disrupt the election cycle. So if Susie Wiles says that, you know, I think that the Susie Wiles is in his world and the donors, I mean, most of the donors, let's, you know, take the crazy ones out of Mike Lindell's, but the people with money like the Schwartzmans, and they don't really want to see that kind of excessive thing. I mean, they don't want to see an outright absence of the trappings of democracy where elections are shut down. I think more concerning is that they might meddle with them in ways that you know, make us look a little bit more like those countries like Russia where, you know, they have an election, but it isn't really an election, you know, and that if they take apart the agencies that are supposed to police that kind of thing, like DOJ or FEC, or so the Elections Commission and so on, I suppose they could, you know, really muck up the process. But again, the fact that she's saying that, I mean, I think she's one of the, like, you know, she's a Trump whisperer, obviously. Maybe, you know, she's somebody who is going to, you know, kind of manage this, what they're calling the clown car of the cabinet. I don't know.
Who do we think is going to stop it, though? I mean, it seems like a lot of people, quote unquote, in corporate America are falling in line because
nobody's going to stop it. That's one thing I talked to my sources about in that piece. Well, you know, we'd love it if corporate America, bankers and like, say, Apple and Google and, you know, Bezos, like, stood up. Well, we already saw the performative preemptive obeisance of Bezos refusing to allow the Post to endorse Harris. And I think, you know, the unfortunate, you know, example is in Nazi Germany, you know, early on, the corporate people were told by the Nazis, hey, you know what? No civil unrest, for 1,000 years. We're going to set this up. You're never going to be bothered again by those pesky labor unions and so on. And they've signed up. They wrote the check. And I think here you have these people literally so short-sighted on the, we'll save tax money. We won't be regulated anymore. Part of this, that they're willing to go pretty far down the line with it. So I don't think that you can look to them to stop any of this. But I do think that the private sector, the business leaders at some point, I think what's going to stop it, Tim, actually, is they're going to eat their own. Within that cabinet, within that White House, it'll be like the first White House of Trump, where you write very early on, you see people just, you know, because they're ill-equipped to be what they're doing, and because of the, you know, system of, you know, you have to be kowtowing to this guy, and it's all about FaceTime and access with this oaf who doesn't listen to anybody. I think they're going to start clawing each other down, and you're going to see, you know, Scaramucci's. Like, you know, the Scaramucci who, you remember, Scaramucci was the shortest-lived comms director in American history, 10 days, extremely profane. And now his name is like a unit of measurement in Trump world. Like, he lasted 4 Scaramuccis, you know what I mean? And I think there are going to be a lot of people lasting not that many Scaramuccis. And there's going to be turnover, and there's going to be chaos. And out of that scrum, who's going to rise up? You know, who's going to be the cool head, or the, you know, the one who sort of says you can't go into the Oval Office right now? I suppose Susie Wiles is that person, but it'll be, I mean, you know, chomping the popcorn, watching these guys, like, I just think they're going to do damage, but they're also going to, I think, damage, they're going to fail within their operation. That's what I think right now, but, you know, ask me tomorrow, because maybe they'll with somebody, you know, some strong man person in there who can really corral them all. But I just think it's going to be this crazy, like they say, you know, this clown car, only not that funny, people just scrumming against each other within that, you know, that Trump organization.
Well, as it says in the subhead of the New Republic article, brace yourself. Nina Burley, journalist and author of the novel Zero Visibility Possible, a contributing editor at the New Republic. The cover story in the magazine is hers this week, called Trump 2.0, Here Comes the Night. Nina, thank you so much for joining us. I'm sure we'll be in touch soon.
You're welcome, and thank you, Tim. Have a great day.
You too. We'll take a break, and when we come back, what the folks at Catskill Mountain Keeper are expecting in the new Trump administration, and how folks can rally and come together as a community to be more involved. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from The Furniture Restore, located on Main Street in Jeffersonville, specializing in antique and vintage furniture, rugs, art, and lighting, because buying well-made and pre-owned is a better choice for the planet. Online at therestorejville.com. And from The River Reporter, the community newspaper serving 4 counties along the Delaware River in Pennsylvania and New York, riverreporter.com. And from listeners like you.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. And this week, we're all about getting you ready for Thanksgiving with turkey tips and really awesome ideas for appetizers and sides you may have never thought about. We've got chefs Eric Repair, Pierre Chum, and Amy Phelan here to make cooking fun this year. It's coming up on The Splendid Table.
The Splendid Table, Sunday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Catskill Mountain Keeper is the nonprofit environmental organization dedicated to protecting the Catskill region. They're emphasizing the importance of community involvement following the recent election. The organization stresses the need for grassroots action to address critical issues facing the region, particularly climate change, which it says is a nonpartisan challenge that affects us all. Jason Dole spoke to Ramsey Adams, executive director of Catskill Mountain Keeper, about the presidential election's outcome on local and state climate goals.
I am personally, you know, still processing what the implications are for the environment. And that's what I do. That's what Mount Keeper's mission is, to promote and protect the region and its environment. And so, you know, a presidential election is a big deal, and it has huge implications at the local level. So what we are doing is working through what we anticipate being the changes as it relates to policies at the federal level, particularly interested in the implications of Lee Zeldin being picked for the EPA. But, you know, I think the main thing I want everybody to share the thought with me is that we are a country of communities. You know, we are made up of communities. And here in the Catskills, we have an amazing community, and it's deeply diverse. And, you know, in Sullivan County, I think the numbers are 58-42, it went Trump. So, you know, Sullivan County is a red county. But the district that encompasses Sullivan County, that was the Molinaro-Riley race, went Riley. So when you take the larger district, it's just super mixed, you know, and that's a gerrymandered district. It doesn't really reflect anything, you know, meaningful for us regionally. It doesn't, you know, follow a geographical border, but it is an indication that we are a very diverse region. And in that diversity is a lot of shared common values. And I think that the opportunity that we have as a community is to find those shared common values. And I believe deeply, I truly believe that we in this community all share the values of wanting a clean environment. We want clean water, fresh, clean air, and we want our lands and our forests protected, and we want our food to be healthy. And that, to me, is an issue that can galvanize shared vision, and we can bridge the bipartisan hatred, you know, the vitriol, by coming together on those issues and, you know, not focusing on the hot button issues that are tearing the country apart. You know, I mean, I'm not, you know, and to be clear, those are important issues and issues I care deeply about. But the overriding issue for me and for Mountain Keeper is the environment, and climate change is the most dire threat to our democracy is the impacts of severe climate change. And I think that's bipartisan. I think people realize that across the board. And I'm not, you know, very optimistic that in the initial phases of the incoming presidential administration, they're going to be talking much about climate change. But I hope that we can together find common ground, even with the presidential, with the president's administration, to find a way to address climate change. But I mean, obviously, the indications are pretty grim at that level. So there, I said a lot.
Right.
But you know, it's important to me that we think about our neighbors and our friends and who have potentially different political views, that we share so much, and we need to find that common ground. And I think that Mountain Keeper can play an important role in doing that here.
Economic concerns and environmental concerns are often pitted against each other. But here in our area, the number one and two industries are tourism and agriculture. And they both bank on the beautiful natural environment that we have. So right there seems to be, you know, one of those areas where you can cross traditional political barriers on the issue that you're most concerned about.
And that's right. I mean, you know, the national election sets the tone for climate policy, but local government is where most of the direct actions on climate take place, right? So, you know, encouraging political engagement at the local level really can lead to meaningful environmental policies that address the needs of the Catskills. And that's bipartisan. You know, I mean, that's the thing about it. You know, these issues, large scale development, you know, the prospect of new cities being built, new resorts and new glamping, you know, resorts and new high end boutique resorts and condos all over the place, highway expansions, you know, these things that are threatening the rural character, the nature of our, of the Catskills, those are shared. And I think that, you know, when, you know, we work with all administrations and all elected officials, you know, that's Mountain Keeper does. We're nonpartisan. You know, we advocate for the environment, and we advocate for the Catskills to promote and protect the region and for the people who live and recreate here. I do think that within New York State, here in the Catskills, we've got a lot of layers of protection that have been put into place over the years, so that, you know, one change in the White House won't, you know, all of a sudden mean that they're going to start fracking all over New York. You know, it doesn't work that way. One of the benefits of the push towards home rule and states is that, you know, we have the ability here to use the state authorities to not let, for example, the fossil fuel industry run roughshod all over New York. You know, if they want to drill baby drill, if that's the national goal, we'll stop them here in New York and certainly keep them out of the Catskills.
You know, you mentioned earlier Lee Zeldin. Lee Zeldin's been pegged by the incoming Trump administration to head off the EPA. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, I think Lee Zeldin's got a rating of 14 out of 100 on his environmental record. You know, I'm not optimistic that he's going to make the environment a top priority. And he doesn't have, you know, a lot of experience during his time here in New York and his time in Washington working on environmental issues. But he, you know, he is from New York. I think he, you know, we have the opportunity to bring him, you know, to the see the important things that we're fighting to protect. And, you know, we'll work with the EPA and try to elevate these issues within that agency. So, I mean, I'm not optimistic about Lee Zeldin being tapped for the EPA, like I said, because he's got a 14 out of 100 rating on the environment from the League of Conservation Voters. So that's, you know, that's where we're starting from. But I want to be optimistic, you know, and, you know, we will work with the administration and with the EPA, and, you know, make sure that the laws that are on the books are enforced, and use the courts to do that.
Before we go, do you have any upcoming campaigns or events or anything going on in Catskill Mountain Keeper that you want folks to know about?
Well, one of the most exciting things that we've been working on, first of all, Mountain Keeper's coming up on its 20th anniversary in 2026. So we're really excited about that. And we're going to have a great year of celebrating our 20th anniversary and celebrating, you know, just how amazing the Catskills are and what a great, you know, 20 years it's been. On our campaign side, you know, I think that like almost everybody here, our biggest concern is large-scale development. So we're launching a campaign called Save the Nature of the Catskills, and that's to educate and empower people, again, just like we've been talking about here, to get engaged at the community level and to push back against exceptions being made to build large-scale developments in rural communities. So that's the Save the Nature of the Catskills campaign. And it's tied into our efforts to stop the expansion into six lanes of Route 17. So together, you know, we're looking at large-scale development as the number one threat to the rural nature of the region. And people can visit our website and get in touch with me and Mountain Keeper to find out how they can get involved.
That's right. Catskill Mountain Keeper is active on social media. The website is catskillmountainkeeper.org. We've been talking to Executive Director of Catskill Mountain Keeper, Ramsey Adams. Ramsey, thank you for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thank you so much.
We'll take a quick break, and when we come back, the SUNY Chancellor is celebrating enrollment gains across the system. We'll hear from him next. This is Radio Catskill.
On the next Jazz Night in America, singer-songwriter Cassandra Wilson.
Ooh, a little moonlight. I love digging inside of a lyric and turning it and twisting it so that it has a certain effect on the listener and also an effect on me.
Hear music from her discography and stories from her life and career. That's next time on Jazz Night in America. I'm Christian McBride. Join me for Jazz Night in America, Sunday at 8, here on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Officials in New York State are celebrating enrollment increases in the State University of New York system. According to the new data, SUNY saw enrollment gains for the second year in a row for the first time in 15 years. Enrollment this fall was up 2.3% system-wide year-over-year, and first-year undergraduate enrollment was up nearly 1%. One person cheering the numbers is the chancellor of the 64-campus system, John King. He spoke to WAMC's Ian Pickus from the New York Public News Network.
First of all, what's driving these increases?
Yeah, there are a number of factors. I think Governor Hochul's commitment to SUNY and to investing in public higher education has been critical. Last year's expansion of the state tuition assistance program so that college is even more affordable in New York was a factor. And we've been doing a lot of work at SUNY to make sure that people know the great opportunities that are available here across our 64 campuses and that SUNY is really where affordability and excellence meet. Tuition at our four-year institutions is just $7,070 for the year. And about 52% of our students go tuition-free because of federal and state financial aid. So it's very accessible, and we're delivering great programs that lead people to great careers in every industry, from the semiconductor industry to green jobs to now leading the way in artificial intelligence.
So resources are obviously always scarce on college campuses. How do you ensure that with the increase in attendance, you have what the students need on campus once they're enrolled?
Look, it's been great to have such a strong partnership with Governor Hochul and our legislative champions. We've gotten the largest increase in state support in 5 decades over the last 2 budget cycles. And we're continuing our conversations with the governor and the legislature about important investments. We want to make sure we have the best faculty available. We want to make sure that we have supports like mental health support for our students, that we have rich extracurricular activities for our students. And we're working towards a goal of an internship for every SUNY undergraduate so that students know when they finish with their degree, they are ready to move into a great job.
Now, we know a lot of people decided not to enroll or took a year off or two during the pandemic. And that was a time of Zoom classes, of course, and a lot of adjustment. So are these numbers just the system recovering to where it expected to be during those years?
Certainly, there's some recovery here from COVID, and we're glad to see that. We also see the potential for even more students to come to SUNY as folks recognize the great value proposition. You know, we've got Micron coming to Central New York. That's going to bring upwards of 50,000 jobs to that region. We want to prepare that workforce. We've got Global Foundries here in the Capital Region leading the way in the semiconductor industry. We want to prepare folks for those jobs. There's huge need in healthcare. Governor's committed that we need to grow our healthcare workforce by 20%. SUNY's going to lead the way on that.
Increasing enrollment is one part of this, but what about retention and graduation rates? We know so many students do not make it through the 4 years or whatever the length of their program to a degree.
You know, we're seeing improvements in persistence at SUNY, driven by some very strategic investments. We have an initiative called ASAP, which is a evidence-based program that provides wraparound support, intensive advising, emergency financial assistance. And that program has been proven to double completion rates in community colleges around the country. We're implementing that program at both two-year and four-year campuses at 25 of our campuses, thanks to investments from Governor Hochul. And we're hoping to grow that program even further. We've got about 4,000 students in that program now. We're hoping to grow it to 10,000 students. And that's helping to shift the culture to say, we've got to do everything we can at our institutions to make sure that students are on the path, not just to start college, but finish college.
You're a former U.S. Secretary of Education before you were the SUNY Chancellor. What is your reaction to President-elect Trump's promise to do away with the Department of Education?
Look, the U.S. Education Department plays a vital role in a number of areas. One, that's the place where the Pell Grant program, which supports student access to higher education, lives. That's the place where the Title I program, which provides aid to high needs K-12 schools, lives. That's the place where civil rights enforcement to make sure that schools are protecting student civil rights lives. So there's a vital role for the U.S. Education Department. Certainly there are folks in Congress who understand that vital role. So I'm sure as the conversations continue, there'll be a lot of rightful attention to all the important things that happen at the U.S. Education Department.
So just to be clear, you know, as a former Secretary of Education and now the SUNY Chancellor, will you advocate against the idea of doing away with the Department of Education?
Of course, I know how important the U.S. Education Department is to our students, our families, our communities, and I'm quite confident that folks across the country, whether you're talking about governors or members of Congress, they too recognize how vital that role is.
What could be the possible impacts on the SUNY system of this new administration, DOE or not? I mean, it's obviously going to be a different approach.
Yeah, look, every new administration brings opportunities and challenges. At SUNY, we're going to be prepared to meet those challenges and make the most of those opportunities. But, you know, so many of the things that we do at SUNY are truly nonpartisan. Whether you're talking about the workforce development role that we play, that's a nonpartisan issue. Or you're talking about the research that we do that's leading the way on identifying diseases earlier and improving treatments, or the research we're doing to strengthen advanced manufacturing, or the research we're doing to help us move towards renewable energy. All of those issues are truly nonpartisan. They're issues of economic development for the state, and we've always worked productively with folks on both sides of the aisle, and I'm sure that will continue to be true.
You know, that being said, Speaker Johnson was in upstate New York stumping late in the campaign. And when asked about the CHIPS Act, he said, well, we might look at repealing that. And that's a statement he later walked back. But obviously, you know, that's a policy that's deeply entwined with the success of the SUNY system, right?
Look, we think it's very important that the United States leads in the semiconductor industry, that we are able to compete effectively with China in that industry. And that's something that is, again, I think a nonpartisan issue ultimately. Around the country, you've seen Republican and Democratic governors and legislators embrace the CHIPS Act because it is going to allow the U.S. to compete economically, and it's good for the U.S. National security. So I'm sure there'll be conversation about how best to move forward, but I'm confident that we're going to see continued investment in the semiconductor industry and semiconductor research, which is a critical leadership role for SUNY.
SUNY Chancellor John King joining us. We really appreciate your time, Chancellor, and congratulations on these positive metrics.
Thanks so much.
And thanks to Ian Pickus of the New York Public News Network for that. You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The winter Main Street Farmers Market is back at the Cooperage in Honesdale. It has a significant impact on the community and local farmers. And here to tell us more is Laurel Burns, the food and market manager for the Cooperage Project. Good morning.
Good morning, Tim. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for being here. And hard to believe it's winter already, or not technically, but cold enough, and the winter Main Street Farmers Market's back. What kind of impact does it have on the community and farmers?
So, you know, the impact on our community is absolutely wonderful and a much needed contribution to their local food sources. You know, a lot of people think that produce in Wayne County and the surrounding areas just kind of stops once cold weather hits. But the reality is that it doesn't. It keeps growing. And we have producers who are able to keep going all year round. And so for those folks who truly desire to eat local, for whatever their reasons might be, the Main Street Farmers Market is here to help them have access to those foods.
And you're there Saturdays from 11 to 1 now through April. What can folks expect when they come by?
So we have just about everything you could possibly want at a farmer's market. We have a wonderful assortment of vegetables right now. The storage crops, a lot of the root vegetables are growing strong. We also have a couple of farms who are able to grow your fresh greens either later into the fall and early winter or just plain year round with one of our farmers. So the produce selection is wonderful. We also have meat, you know, poultry, beef, pork, wide variety there. We have some fruit, not a lot, but some, and also your value added products. So that's things like pickles and preserves. We also have a couple of bakeries on site bringing the, you know, desserts and sweets, but also bread and rolls and things like that to complement your meal. So, oh, and we have cheese as well. I wanted to mention the cheese and the eggs.
Thank you for not forgetting the cheese.
Everything is better with cheese.
Are there some new vendors this year that you wanted to highlight?
So we have a couple of new ones who are joining us, at least for 2024 markets. We'll see if they decide to join us into January and beyond. But we have Wildflower Bakehouse, which is another bakery that has joined us. She has wonderful handcrafted alternatives to things you might find in the store. I'm not going to name brand names, but if you can imagine some of the foil-wrapped breakfast pastries, she has a version that she makes herself that's absolutely out of this world and nothing like the grocery store. And then we also have some folks joining us to bring in some craft products that are new to the market for us this year. So we've got some soaps and some, you know, artisan body care products as well.
You guys also have your own cafe there, Red Door Cafe.
Correct, correct. So we call our cafe space the Red Door Cafe. But coming back again this year to operate the cafe is the Mustard Seed Catering from Waymart. And they have quite a following from their restaurant days. They've currently shifted into more of a catering and what they call their Sunday suppers program. So, yeah, if you enjoyed Mustard Seed Cafe foods from when they had their restaurant, you can certainly come by the market and our Red Door Cafe, and you'll find Lori and her staff with the same fresh farm-to-table foods that you're used to.
And in effort to get fresh food out to more folks, you also accept SNAP benefits. And there's something called Farmers Market Near Cash. What's that?
Yes, yes. So we are able to accept SNAP benefits. What we do at the Main Street Farmers Market is that we convert your SNAP dollars into Near Cash. Near Cash is a program that was developed at the Cooperage Project, and it's designed to allow individuals to use their SNAP benefits with our local farms and food producers, because it's very cumbersome, both in terms of time and financially, for a farm or small food producer to be able to accept SNAP on their own. However, we have taken all those steps to be able to accept SNAP as the Cooperage Project, and we convert it into Near Cash, which you can then spend with the farmers. It saves them all that back-end administrative work, and it still lets you as a SNAP beneficiary have access to the local foods. And the great thing is that through grant funding, we are able to offer an extra incentive. So if you exchange at least $10 in SNAP funds, you'll receive a $10 Near Cash incentive. So if you stop by the staff table at the market and say, I want to exchange $10 of my SNAP money, you'll actually get $20 in Near Cash that you can then spend with most of the vendors there at the market.
That is Laurel Burns, who is the food and market manager for the Cooperage Project, telling us about the Main Street Farmers Market for the winter, which is going on now through April 26, Saturdays from 11 to 1 at the Cooperage in Honesdale. More information at thecooperageproject.org. Laurel, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you for the opportunity.
All right. And before we go, one last arts and culture thing to tell you about. Sloan Wainwright from the acclaimed family of artists you may have heard of, brother Loudon, sister-in-law Kate McGarrigle, nephew Rufus, nieces Martha and Lucy. She's performing Sunday at Music on the Delaware. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi spoke with Jim Richardson, one of the founders of Music on the Delaware, about that and other programs.
Good morning, listeners, and welcome to Radio Chatskill. And today I am speaking with James, who is representing Music on the Delaware out of Walton, New York. Welcome, James.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Now, Music on the Delaware has been around for 3 decades.
Well, so to be very honest with you, we're not really sure when we started, but that's close. We started really a group of us who were sort of helping out the music department when our kids were in school. And I guess when our kids graduated, we felt we had to do something else. So we started bringing in groups.
What a wonderful use of your time.
Well, I know. It's not exactly what I thought retirement would be, but it's fun.
And I see also that you have a very strong youth program there.
Yes, we do. That's something that we actually right from the very beginning, we made the commitment that whatever we did, whatever groups we brought in, we wanted to get as many of them into the schools to do workshops or mini concerts or whatever. And we've done that in the entire time. And that is, I say this is fun, but that is really fun because, you know, it's just so great to see these students of all ages because we basically base it on whatever the school wants, and to see these kids interacting with these musicians. Well, it doesn't always, you know, go over great with every kid, but for some kids, you know, you'll see them at the end of the period. They don't want to leave. They're sitting on the stage, you know, talking to the musicians and so on. So, and I think you were about to ask me what sort of things do we do. I'll give you an example. We just had a 16-piece big band from Boston. Now the band director and the vocalist went around to actually 8 different classrooms. We really worked them this time. But in the case of an elementary school, they gave like a mini concert, but explaining their instruments and showing the different sounds that would come out of the trombone or how Kimberly would make different sounds with her voice. And then with the senior high, I'm thinking about one of the classes, they sat basically in a circle with the kids and they had sent music in advance. So the kids were learning it, they sent vocal music and instrumental music. And so then the kids all performed with them and the kids were all invited to come to the Saturday night concert and be up on the stage with about a dozen of them did do. So that was exciting.
A nice gift to the community for sure.
Well, the kids really enjoy it. That's, you know, as I say, there's some kids that, you know, this is not their thing, but seems we're mostly doing it with music kids. Almost all of them are really into it. So
yes.
It's very neat.
Now, I notice you have 2 spaces where you have performances, the main stage and the coffee house. Can you tell us a little bit about those venues?
Sure. We put the shows on in the Walton Theater, which is a 110-year-old theater. We just had a 110th birthday anniversary there. And it's most of us are involved with restoring that theater also. So we use the main theater part of it, which is about 515-520 seats. And so that's our main stage concerts. And then upstairs, we restored a room that probably was a courtroom at one time for the village. And we restored that into a small, more intimate space. And we put in some lighting, some special lighting, and we brought in a temporary short stage, like 4 inches high, just to raise the groups up above the audience. And we have tables and chairs, and all the tables have little cabaret lights on them, and we have free desserts. And the groups we yet are pretty much groups from a radius of, say, let's say 50 miles. and which is amazing when you see the talent that comes through there. And these are all basically local groups. And it's a whole range of music. I mean, we had a group that was playing basically gypsy music. And then we had a classical cello player. So we've got a whole range of things that appear up there, and people love it. I mean, it's all casual. It's free. We just take donations, and it's just a nice. People tend to say, "Oh, Sunday afternoon, I'm going to just stay home," but oh, I'll go. And then it's like a nice way to end the weekend. Just it's been wonderful.
Now you have an event coming up on Sunday, November 11th, from 6
yes.
to 8. Can you tell us about that and the venue?
Yeah, that's one of the coffee houses. We have those coffee houses once a month. And this particular Sunday is Sloan Wainwright, who is a singer-songwriter who actually is located in Delhi. She's very close to us. And I believe she's going to bring a couple of people with her. Sometimes they do this. So, you know, we'll sign somebody up, and then they end up bringing somebody with them. And basically for these coffee houses, we pay just a flat fee, no matter what. And, you know, if they want to do it, they come. And if they don't, you know, if there's not enough money for them, but that's just the way we do it. And actually, I don't think we've had anybody turn us down, because these are so often musicians who just really love playing. And they love playing in that kind of environment, because it's not like a bar where everybody's talking. People are really listening. And so Sloan is a singer-songwriter, and so we're really looking forward to that. The last one was also a singer-songwriter, and people love that. So it's and we've had really a full house for the last year. That's how lucky we've been in the groups that we've brought in.
Yeah, well, there is a lot of talent up in these hills.
There really is. There really is. It's unbelievable. And I mean, Sloan Wainwright is actually a member of a very well-known musical family.
Yes,
comes out of Canada. The McGonagall sisters. I don't know whether they were grandparents of hers or not. I'm not too sure, but I mean, she's a great singer songwriter on her own.
And is she related to Loudon Wainwright?
Yes, she is. Yes. I'm not sure of the relation.
Yeah.
I looked it up at one time, but I sort of forgot it. But she doesn't play that up. I mean, she doesn't say, "Hey, come hear me. I'm Loudon Wainwright's whatever."
Okay. Well, I want to thank you so much for sharing this with us, and have a wonderful time on Sunday. And we will be back in touch with you, because you have a wonderful Christmas event coming up. So we'll be
back in
touch in December to get the skinny on all of that. So thank you very much.
Okay, good. Because that is a sellout concert, and I don't think we sound very professional, but I'm really not too sure how we ever got them the first time, because they are, the Cherish the Ladies is a international group. I mean, that's it. And they bring Irish step dancers, and it's just a phenomenal concert.
Well, wonderful. Please give us your website so folks can see what you've done in the past and what's coming up.
Okay. It's musiconthedelaware.org.
Oh, that was simple.
Isn't that simple? Yeah. And actually, if they go to waltontheater.org, they can also flip over to Music on the Delaware. But the Music on the Delaware is the best place to go.
Okay.
But one of the things we do with all of our live, our main stage concerts, we also stream them. Because we have some people, I mean, we've had people from all over the country sign in and stream some of these concerts.
Wonderful.
But it's nice also for some of the elderly people who don't want to go out at night on a Sunday night.
Nice to have that option.
Yes.
So thank you again.
Well, thank you very much.
And thanks to culture reporter Valerie Manzi for that. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Keep up with the newest music from some of your favorite singer-songwriters with Now and Then. I'm Kathy Geary. Check it out. Now and Then, Saturday afternoons at 3 on Radio Catskill. Listen local.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's forecast, turning cloudy this afternoon, a high 41. Tonight's low 30. And for the weekend, increasingly cloudy, increasingly windy, Friday through Saturday, highs in the 50s.